Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Saint Stephen with a rose, in and out of the garden he goes. Country garden in the wind and the rain, wherever he goes, people all complain. Stephen prosper in his time. Well, he may and he may decline. Did it matter? Does it now? Stephen would answer if he only knew how.
I'm in this world of, I have no idea what's going on. Everything that I thought was true about the world has just been turned on its head. And now I'm questioning everything. And there's this guy, Alex Jones, blurting off with a megaphone about how confident he is in his view of the world. Sure, he's wrong 7 out of 8 times, but he's confident, so I'm going to follow him.
I'm a weapon. I'm made to be thrown at you.
Rachel Maddow is wrong 7 out of 8 times, but she's confident, so I'll follow her.
The Russians rush against the U.S. The Russian government scheme. The Russians.
Bill O'Reilly's wrong 7 out of 8 times, but he's confident, so I'll follow him.
Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
This cult leader has said the world is going to end this date, and they were wrong. It was going to end this other date, and they were wrong. It was going to end this third date, and they were wrong, but they're still confident, so I'm going to follow them. Confidence is so important.
Or at the very least, because there's a whole inner world that's not being explored, because we can't explore it. We don't know these people. They're showcasing the mechanics of confidence.
Yes.
They've figured out how to present, how to commit. Yeah, Alex Jones has a worldview. Rachel Maddow has a worldview. Bill O'Reilly has a worldview. And that helps them probably at least maintain the illusion of sincerity inside their own heads, like we talked about earlier. But through this kind of training and repetition, they understand the mechanics of confidence. Some of them might get more training than others. Like Rachel Maddow might have had more training, while Alex Jones kind of had to figure it out on cable access television 25 years ago. But it's the mechanics of confidence.
One of the hallmarks of the confidence artist has to do with manipulating people for your own ends, getting them to do what you want them to do, but without their knowledge, so that they don't realize they're being manipulated, so that they think that everything they're doing is of their own volition. People hate feeling manipulated. The moment you think you're being manipulated, you drop out. You say, hey, no one tells me what to do. Who are you to manipulate me? And so the con doesn't work. So the trick is, how do I, you know, give you the germ of the idea so that you think it's your idea? How do I set up a situation so that it's your proposal, not my proposal, so that you're the one who's in charge? You would be shocked if anyone told you otherwise. In fact, oftentimes when people say, hey, do you realize that this might be a con? You'll laugh and you say, absolutely not. Are you insane? This is totally legitimate. Besides, it was my idea.
Well, breaking news this evening, Joe Rogan, an extremely popular podcaster, announced on social media today that he has COVID. Rogan has said young, healthy people don't need to get vaccinated. In his statement on social media, Rogan said he has taken several therapeutics to recover.
Turns out I got COVID. So we immediately threw the kitchen sink at it. All kinds of meds, monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, Z-Pak, prednisone, everything.
One of those drugs he mentioned, ivermectin, is something more often used to deworm horses. CDC says there's no evidence it works on COVID. Its increased usage has only led to a substantial increase in overdoses after a push by some on the far right seeking vaccine misinformation. Perspective now from our chief media correspondent and anchor of CNN's Reliable Sources, Brian Stelter, and Dr. Lena Wen, CNN medical analyst and former Baltimore Health Commissioner. Brian, this is obviously someone who has said on his podcast that you know, healthy young people probably don't need to get vaccinations. What's he saying about his condition?
Yeah, and he is one of the most influential figures in all of media, especially among young men. He has a podcasting deal with Spotify worth $100 million, but in the past he has downplayed the vaccine, and in this case he seems to have admitted he has COVID because it's hurting him in the pocketbook. He had to postpone or reschedule one of his upcoming stage shows. So you'd think the economic consequences might get people's attention and make his fans think differently about the threat of COVID. But he's trying to portray this as if he is feeling better now, he's doing better now, because of this cocktail of drugs and medications that he has taken. Of course, some of these are under emergency use authorizations, others have been, discouraged by the CDC and the FDA. But when you have a horse deworming medication that's discouraged by the government, that actually causes some people in this crazed environment we're in to actually want to try it. That's the upside down world we're in with figures like Joe Rogan.
So, Dr. Wen, ivermectin, apparently given to deworm animals. Why are people using this? I mean, I know, you know, it's being spread online and stuff, but what is the theory that it works?
Well, I think there are some people who want to believe that there is
a magic pill
for COVID, which, of course, we would all want.
I hope you guys had a good Labor Day weekend. You did? Yeah. Yeah, Americans got together to fire up the grill, grab a cold beer, and toss back some horse dewormer. Mm. But don't worry about the anti-vaxxers being unprotected, because they have found a new drug that also does not protect them. It's called ivermectin, which is a horse dewormer. So you'll probably still get COVID, but on the bright side, you could win the Preakness. We've still got a lot of pandemics out there. People are still taking this ivermectin. This poison, you know, the poison control centers have seen this spike in calls from people taking this livestock medicine to fight the coronavirus, but they won't take the vaccine, which is crazy. It's like if you're a vegan and you're like, no, I don't want a hamburger. Give me that can of Alpo instead.
I gotta say, when I first heard that Fox News was pushing ivermectin, I knew it was gonna be bad, but I was not expecting it to be horse dewormer. Sounds like the name of a drug they give super soldiers in a Paul Verhoeven movie to turn them into RoboCop. You know, someone at the company that made ivermectin once said, hey, should we put not for people on the horse pill labels? And someone else said, there's a picture of a horse on the bottle. It's fine.
So, ivermectin is ineffective against COVID. And when used incorrectly, it can kill you. Worst of all, it tastes yucky. Luckily, the internet is loaded with advice on how to make it more palatable, including mixing it with jellies or eating it as a sandwich. Or throw it on your roast beef. Technically, it is horsey sauce.
Dr. Fauci said that if hospitals get any more overcrowded, they're going to have to make some very tough choices about who gets an ICU bed. That choice doesn't seem so tough to make. Vaccinated person having a heart attack? Yes, come right on in. We'll take care of you. Unvaccinated guy who gobbled horse goo? Rest in peace, Wheezy.
You can get away with anything. It all comes down to style. You'll have a captive audience as long as you beguile. Yes, you can have your cake and eat it, the love of those whom you betray. But you can't get away with anything if you don't get away. Yes, I can get away with everything because I have no shame, 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 shame.
The ordinary man places his life's happiness in things external to him. In property, rank, wife and children, friends, society, and the like. So that when he loses them or finds them disappointing, the foundation of his happiness is destroyed. In other words, his center of gravity is not in himself. It is constantly changing its place with every wish and whim. When our self-concept is tied to external things, then the order of our self mirrors the order of the outer world. When that order is stable, so too is our sense of self. But when that order breaks down, perhaps from an economic, social, or personal crisis, then those with a constructed self also tend to break down. To avoid the vulnerability of a constructed self, we need to replace it with a discovered self. A discovered self is cultivated through the development of virtues, skills, character traits, and other personal capacities rather than being constructed upon external achievements. This sense of self is discovered in that it is who we become as we actualize our latent potentials and develop our unique capacities in interaction with the world. And as Al Siebert explains, resiliency comes from a discovered self, not a constructed self. It comes from the gradual emergence of your unique inborn abilities in a process called individuation. The better you become, the more unique you become as an individual, and it never ends. If your identity is based mostly on external factors, you will feel anxious about change that threatens your identity sources. You will try to keep the world around you frozen in place. If your identity is based on your personal qualities, abilities, and values, you can let parts of your world dissolve away without feeling threats to your existence. With a strong inner sense of who you are, you can easily adapt and thrive in new environments. A discovered self is far more effective in the battle of life for two main reasons. Firstly, the inner order to which it is anchored is far more stable and under our control than the outer order of the constructed self. Secondly, a discovered self is far more adaptive as the process that leads to its emergence, namely self-development, imbues us with all sorts of skills and capacities that can be used to confront life's battles. Michel de Montaigne, a 16th century philosopher, was a man who spent much of his life in active pursuit of a discovered self. and the following passage could easily serve as the ethos for the rest of us who want to follow on this path. Not being able to govern events, I govern myself, and if they will not adapt to me, I adapt to them. The surest way to the cultivation of a discovered self is to find a life purpose or mission and to orient our days around its pursuit. A purpose can be any meaningful long-term goal that promotes human flourishing. It can be a creative goal, such as mastering a craft or skill, a practical goal, such as starting a business, or a courageous goal, such as devoting ourselves to culturally important values, such as freedom. But whatever we choose, our purpose must be challenging and inspiring, and it should be chosen by us, not for us. When we find a purpose and begin living the purposeful life, our discovered self begins to emerge. For with a purpose, we are confronted daily with new tasks and challenges, and so we create an ideal training ground for our self-development. When we live with purpose, in other words, we expand our skills and capacities voluntarily, not only when forced to, and in the process, we actualize our potentials and unearth the discovered self. While some may view the call to live with purpose as cliché, in actual fact, it can be a matter of sanity versus madness, or even life versus death. This point was stressed by the Dutch doctor and author Joost Mierlo, who lived through the Nazi invasion of Holland and was a member of the anti-Nazi resistance. Mierlo spent time studying the psychological effects of being a prisoner of a concentration camp. As he notes, most people, when plucked from their homes and shipped to prison merely for reasons of political corruption and human cruelty, do not cope well. But as he further points out, there are some individuals who not only endure such conditions, but can even be said to flourish in spite of them. And integral to this astonishing ability is living with a purpose, a mission, or inner goal. When we look at the varieties of human behavior under extreme and pressing circumstances, we see how easily man can be subdued. And at the same time, we see that certain factors seem to have a positive effect on his morale, keeping him from despair and collapse. When these factors are operative, the spirit revives, and people are enabled to live with integrity in spite of dangerous circumstances. There are many such morale boosters. Perhaps the most effective is the sense of having some mission and inner goal. Whatever it is, at the moment of calamity, a guiding idea is as much needed as mere physical strength and endurance. The psychologist Viktor Frankl, who spent time in a Nazi concentration camp, echoes Mierlo's observations. Frankl went so far as to say that for him and his fellow prisoners, a purpose was the difference between life and death. Without a purpose or a future goal to look forward to, prisoners found it very difficult to endure the uncertainty and brutal conditions of camp life. Frankl notes that many purposeless individuals succumb to what he called give-up-itis. One morning, they simply refused to get up, and as he wrote, "At that moment, we knew that for the next 48 hours or so, we would watch them dying." While hopefully we will not be a generation forced to endure the brutalities of government prison camps, what the future has in store for us is never known. Social uncertainty is clouding our future, tyranny is intensifying across the globe, and our ability to live free and economically prosperous lives is under grave threat. And so, while living with a purpose and cultivating a discovered self is a wise choice even at times of social stability, as it promotes greatness of self, in our generation, it may be the difference between thriving in tumultuous times versus merely suffering in response to the chaos that swirls around us. If there is any period one would desire to be born in, is it not the age of revolution? When the old and the new stand side by side and admit of being compared? When the energies of all men are searched by fear and by hope? When the historic glories of the old can be compensated by the rich possibilities of the new era? This time, like all times, is a very good one, if we but know what to do with it.
Speeding arrow, sharpened arrow, what a lot of fleeting matters you have spurned. Several seasons with their treasons, wrap the babe in scarlet colors, call it your own. Mm-hmm. answers are plenty by and by. Talk about your plenty, talk about your ills. One man gathers what another man spills. Saint Stephen will remain. All he's lost, he shall regain. Seashore washing with the suds and the foam. Been here so long, he's got to calling it home. Garden he goes, country garden in the wind and the rain. Wherever he goes, people all complain.
Nathan, welcome back.
Brett, I'm glad to be back. It's been way too long.
This is the longest absence of emotional manipulators for hire since we started. We're certainly doing the show against the backdrop of a very dynamic world. So how have you been? I'm kind of interested, too, since I enjoy your Facebook so much, what you've been paying attention to, like, this week.
Oh, gosh. I try to be conscious of what I pay attention to. I'm a very firm believer of, like, the garbage in, garbage out. Whatever you consume becomes what you think about, becomes what you produce. And so I try to not let so much of the craziness in. Always kind of keep your head on a swivel, but not be absorbed with all of it. Right now, I'm reading a advertising book by Victor Schwab, and that is taking up most of my media consumption. And then obviously the typical culture war, COVID craziness, but I try to keep that at a limit and spend more of my time absorbing marketing and copywriting materials from the greats.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I've been having kind of a similar experience. As you and I have talked about privately, I'm planning on starting a new podcast project this fall, and it's going to require a lot of garbage in. And I'm trying to prepare myself for this mentally and emotionally. So I've actually been reading some books about media literacy. I'm on to the second one now. It's called Mind Over Media. Might be, I'm only in chapter two, it might be actually left-wing propaganda masquerading as media literacy. I'm going to find out as I read a little bit further, but this is the next book for our University book club. And I've also been going through Will Durant's History of Philosophy. So this 2,500-year-old conversation, boy, a lot of the issues that people are wrestling with and struggling with today that seem novel, if you abstract them, these are not new problems in their most general sense, what we're dealing with today. So I'm trying to strengthen my mind as much as possible in the middle of this hard audit of School Sucks, now that we're here at the end of it. This will be the third to final show. There's two shows after this one before the School Sucks podcast is over. So this hard audit is very much about mindset, presentation, habit, time management with work, so I can put my best foot forward in starting something new in the very near future. But yes, there is this, I'm knowing that I am going to become a bit of a dumpster as far as the media that I'm going to be obligated to take in to do this. And I think that's actually part of the challenge that I like, is that can I stay educational and constructive while consuming complete and utter garbage? And I'm confident that the answer is yes.
I'm going to be praying for your mental health. I look at people like Tim Pool or people that are in that kind of like content world where they're just constantly looking at the most absurd and depressing things all day and having to turn it into content. And bro, if I had to spend 8 to 10 hours a day absorbing that stuff and then spitting it back out, I don't know if I'd be able to maintain my sanity.
Right. Well, I'm not a psycho, so I'm not going to spend 8 to 10 hours a day doing it. That's for sure. But, you know, it was clarifying in myself and then clarifying to this future audience and the other people who are going to be participating as co-hosts. Priority one is fun. Priority one is fun. I said in our mastermind that what I'm looking to do is to combine the spirit of the comedy show that I do, Portman Show, which used to be Puke and the Gang, with the knowledge and wisdom that we try to impart on the School Sucks podcast. But it's Puke and the Gang first, School Sucks second, but not in a punching down way, not at an expense at the expense of others way. It's fun and love and constructiveness, and I'm really looking forward to it. As long as I can maintain that mindset about it, it's going to be a huge success.
I have faith. At first, I wasn't sold, and then you started talking more about it, and I was like, okay, this is something I would listen to, and if I listen to it, the world is going to love it.
Yes, I agree. I appreciate that endorsement. So that brings us to the 11th installment of Emotional Manipulators for Hire. This is, I think, the least I have ever been prepared for one of these shows, but it is also perhaps the most excited I have been. And maybe those two things are related. And maybe that speaks to the topic that we're actually going to be covering today, confidence.
Yeah, the importance of confidence. A lot of people get it twisted on what they think they're selling. They think that they're selling this thing, or they're selling this product or their service. Smarter marketers think that they're selling a transformation. I'm not selling this vacation. I'm selling a recharge, a reignition of your relationship. I'm selling this transformation from a dull marriage to an exciting marriage. I'm not selling a vacation. I'm not selling a car wax. I'm selling a transformation into somebody who has a more exotic looking car, who gets more dates because their car looks better. Really, though, we're not selling the transformation. What we're selling is confidence. People lack confidence in all different areas of their life. Where people are most apt to spend money is areas where they want more confidence in their life. And as salespeople, we're selling confidence. And there's a lot of ways that that could go wrong. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that people can abuse the fact that people are so desperate for confidence. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about, why confidence is important in sales, but also how confidence is used to scam people into following leaders that probably don't deserve to be followed.
So it's kind of like selling people their own untapped or unrealized confidence they could have in the right situation or with the right tools.
Sometimes there's two different markets. Sometimes people want to buy something that will make them confident. Sometimes people just want to buy someone who they have confidence in. So sometimes I want a system that shows me how to do this thing. You sell me this simple three-step process and I'll have confidence that I can do it. Sometimes I don't want that though. Sometimes I just want to buy somebody who's confident and just say, hey, you do it for me. So either way though, whether I'm wanting confidence in myself or I'm wanting confidence in you, what I want is confidence.
So would a good place to start be to talk about some examples out there in the world that you really like and some others that you're not such a fan of?
You know, I'd like to start with con men, because the word con man comes from the term confidence man. It's somebody who boosts up your amount of confidence in you in order to take you for a ride and take you for all you're worth. You think about like the Lifetime movie where the 65-year-old woman falls in love with the 45-year-old con man. And he's like, oh, baby, we're going to go on vacation and we're going to take on the world. And I'm going to help you turn your retirement investment into something that's going to make us millions and you'll never have to work again. And she says, okay, here's my social security number and my routing number. And then 2 days later, he's gone and you can't find him. But in order to get to that point where she handed over all of her life savings, he had to get her bought in to the confidence. He had to be confident. He had to make her feel like he was confident. And we see that all over the place, not just in one-on-one relationships, but a lot of religion is based off of that. A lot of politics is based off of that. A lot of marketing is based off of that. So kind of starting with con men and looking at the different cons that go on out there and why people keep falling for these confidence men and women out there.
Yeah, and a lot of it is hard to notice if you're not being conscious of it, like what the little techniques and gestures, orientations of the body, like all of these things contribute to this picture of persuasion. And just from listening to you talk about the confidence man and the confidence scheme, I feel I should enter into the record like mainstream media handlers, maybe not the people who show up in front of the cameras. Maybe they're not wizards when it comes to all this, but they're carefully trained, I would say, by people who understand the subtleties of persuasion.
Yeah, and that actually leads to a good example of this. They've got their handlers, but they're the faces. We see this time and time again where I think just recently Rachel Maddow shared a story about people overdosing on ivermectin in Oklahoma. And it was such a bad problem that gunshot victims were having to line up and wait to be treated because all of the emergency room was overtaken by people who were overdosing on ivermectin. And it ended up being completely fake news. But instead of apologizing for it, instead of doing the walk of shame, she just pretends like it didn't even happen and she just keeps on going about her business. Bill O'Reilly on the other side is one of those guys who's always talking about nice Christian conservative values, but then he gets caught up in his own scandals of sexual misconduct. Rush Limbaugh, rest in peace. I'm not a Rush Limbaugh fan, but I don't want to speak ill of the dead. But another example of a guy who built his career railing on about, oh, these drug addicts in the inner city, these heroin addicts, these cocaine users, they're mooches on the system, they're worthless, they're just drug addicts. And then it comes out that he's addicted to pain pills and it doesn't affect him. His audience keeps going. We have these gold bugs. I don't know how long you've been in this alternative media industry, but we've got the economy is going to crash tomorrow. Buy your gold, buy your Bitcoin. Same story for the 20 plus years that I've been in it.
Yep.
And every week, next week is going to be the economic collapse. Buy all your gold today. Next week, the economy doesn't collapse, but hey, it's actually the week after next. So buy your gold today.
No, it's actually had me asking a lot of questions. Like, obviously, yeah, I follow Peter Schiff. I loved, you know, the Peter Schiff is Right compilations about the financial crisis in 2008, the housing bubble. And now I'm wondering, like, boy, maybe I need to hit the books again on economics because maybe they can just print money forever, right? Like maybe these guys are wrong. And this thing that I've taken completely for granted all these years in a lot of maybe what shows up in my mind sometimes is like a doomsday mentality is like somehow in a way that just defies all the logic that I have access to, government monetary policy is completely sustainable, which makes me wonder about like why the IRS would be chasing any of us.
Just to make sure that the system stays together. And I kind of want to clarify, like, I actually do think that it's not sustainable. I do think that all of it does have to come crashing down eventually. I don't know how long we can kick the can down the road. I'm not that smart. I think there's some truth to it, but I'm also willing to admit that even though I agree with these guys and I think that there's truth to it, I definitely see them pull the confidence scam over and over again.
Yeah, it is at this point basically a dead heat between the political, the social, and the economic as far as like what's going to bring the whole thing down, right? It could be any one of the three. Hey, I want to go back to Rachel Maddow. Reminds me of something that I put in the introduction to one of our recent shows where I was talking to you about Chomsky doing an interview. I think I said it was one of the big three American networks, but I think it might have been the BBC, and it was like in the 80s or the 90s. And they were having this contentious discussion about manufacturing consent, and the journalist asserted something like, so you're saying I'm a liar, right? And Chomsky goes, no, absolutely not. I'm saying that if you stop believing this, you'll be replaced with somebody who does. And if you think about Maddow, it's like, people could call her dishonest or a liar, and maybe there's some truth to that. But a lot of those people who get into those talking head positions or those news slash opinion show positions on CNN or MSNBC or Fox, they're very much true believers, right? You don't have to worry about them lying. It's almost like they have this kind of like plausible deniability because their ideology blinds them, right? They're editing things out of their reality that don't conform to their comfortable beliefs. What interrupts confidence? Overthinking, over practicing, deliberating, you know, these kinds of things. One of the things that I think stops us from action is we think about things too much. And then we can kind of pick something apart, and that just results in inaction. So if you think about these people, they're just ready to get in front of that camera and spout the same bullshit that they believe is undeniable truth every night because they're not overthinkers. Those aren't bright, contemplative people. And that makes them perfect for that role where they can operate there without having to shut off the bedroom light every night and fall asleep feeling like they're a liar. I think they believe they're doing a good thing. You might disagree.
No, I think that they're probably drinking their own Kool-Aid. I also take it from not from their point of view, but from their viewers' point of view. If you look at someone like Alex Jones, there's the meme, the Alex Jones was right tip jar. You put a quarter in it every time Alex Jones was right about something and you have enough money to go on a vacation. Alex Jones is wrong a lot of times as well. He's wrong a lot. And his diehard fans, every time he's wrong, they just ignore it. And they only remember the times that he was right. And same thing with Rachel Maddow. She was wrong about the very fine people quote. If you look at the full context, it's the exact opposite of what she says. But her fans will ignore the times that they were wrong, and they will double down on the times that they were right. And it's something that as people, when we decide this is our cult, this is our leader, I'm going to forgive and forget and, like you said, go back and edit out of my memory every time that they were wrong, and I'm going to give more precedence to the times that they were right or the times that they backed up what I want to believe.
Yeah, so maybe I'm just kind of an oddball, but I wonder if you feel the same way. Like, I really like Alex Jones on Joe Rogan, where Joe Rogan like pushes on him and forces him to make concessions and forces him to be introspective and say, well, I don't know, maybe I'm being hyperbolic, or maybe I'm, going too far with that. Like, that, there's something that's really appealing about that for me. And I also had this fantasy through the Trump years where I would watch him and be like, it would be cool if he just said something like, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. Or, I wish I had known more before I did this or I said this. And that never happened. And somebody who is such a good manipulator and persuader like Trump or like Alex Jones, they seem to understand that most people, I'm in a tiny minority of people who actually like that kind of thoughtfulness when it comes to a figure like that.
Uh-huh. What it goes back to is the very beginnings of tribalism. When we were in a tribe, we were in a family, and the leader of the tribe or the father of the family, if he showed any weakness whatsoever, somebody would come in, beat him to death, rape his wife, and kidnap his kids for slaves. If the leader of the tribe showed any weakness whatsoever, somebody would come in and attack the village and do what they wanted with the women, do what they wanted with the children. And so you never showed, even if you knew you were wrong, even if you knew you were weak, you never showed weakness. And if you wanted the tribe to stay behind you, even if they knew you were wrong, they did not want to see you show weakness, because that meant that it might mean extinction. So we follow the guy who, even when he's wrong, he won't admit he's wrong, because most of the time he's right.
And I wonder if we're kind of seeing that now on both sides, the subtle psychic effect of people deep down knowing that they're being bullshitted. Yeah. Because, yes, we continue to see the talking heads in mainstream media, different types of ideological leaders doubling down and not retreating and never showing any like open introspection. But it seems costly, right? As it just creates this more cacophonous and confusing world for most people. and the possibility of dialogue that I know some people are doing. You think about like the intellectual dark web. Like, I'm not a huge fan of most of those guys, but I like some of them. I respect most of them. And the fact that they're having, you know, difficult conversations about points of disagreement is an exciting thing. But in the mainstream, there is none of that happening. Yeah, I saw Dave Rubin had Tucker Carlson on a show recently. And Tucker Carlson is kind of a standout in that crowd as being fairly thoughtful and introspective about what he does and why and how he wants to do it. And I just, again, I had this fantastical thought of like, it would be cool to see him do a roundtable with other like mainstream media personalities about like their method and their approach to their job. And then like I stop myself mid-thought and go, that's impossible. You know, that's just, you're never going to see anything like that.
If you look at like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you can't really think about some of these things until other needs are already met. You have to have food and shelter taken care of. You have to have security taken care of. And then you can start thinking about these deeper thoughts. But for the majority of people out there, they're still in the, I'm working 40 hours a week to barely make rent, to go pay paycheck to paycheck, to hopefully be able to afford enough food for the family this week, to hopefully be able to keep a roof over our head, to hopefully keep the car payment getting paid. So they're still stuck at those bottom layers. I mean, we live comfortably. We have a lot more comfort, creature comforts than any other generation has ever had. But a lot of people are still stuck in those very base levels of the hierarchy of needs. And so they're not looking for people who will apologize and re-examine themselves. They're looking for the people that will give them confidence. And that's why for me and you, we might be attracted to something different, but for the majority of people out there, they're not at the point where they're thinking about these higher level things yet.
Yeah, like discourse, that's definitely something for the leisure class, right?
Exactly.
That doesn't just mean people who are working like paycheck to paycheck. It means anybody who is consuming a mainstream media narrative where it's like, hey, look, buddy, you're going to fucking die. It doesn't matter if you wear your mask. It doesn't matter if you got your vaccine. There's people out there who are selfish and stupid and dangerous and basically trying to kill you. Like, that is the mainstream media messaging coming out of the summer and moving into the fall. And I don't see that improving. And the more dire the situation seems, I think you're right, the more absolute they want their leadership. For those very tribal reasons that you spoke of, the more absolute they want their so-called leadership to be, whether that leadership is political or that leadership is just ideological.
Yep. So both in sales and in politics and media, the more stressed out, the more confused, the more in fear the prospect is, the more attracted they are to someone who has courageous confidence, the more willing they are to give up their own autonomy to have somebody else tell them exactly what to do. And we'll kind of get into that more later. But one of the things that I've noticed coming up more and more frequently as far as maintaining the confidence in the narrative, breaking people up into these different tribes and making sure that they stay confident in the leaders of those tribes. I remember when we were kids, we used to go to church and there were certain things we just weren't allowed to do. We weren't allowed to play Dungeons and Dragons. We weren't allowed to listen to this type of music. There was books. You better never think about reading a book from this author because you'll go to hell. The demons will subtly get into your subconscious and they'll take over you and you won't be granted permission to get into heaven. This idea of like forbidden texts, forbidden materials that will shake your confidence, because it's not so much that you'll become demon possessed or demonically possessed by reading this, but you'll start to ask questions and you'll start to see things from a different point of view. And then you'll start to say, well, do I really have confidence that what I've been told my whole life is the truth? Or does this new idea that I've been exposed to actually have some merit? And we see that in cults where they pull people away. You're not allowed to talk to your family. You're not allowed to talk to your friends. You can't associate with anybody who might break your confidence in what the great leader of the cult says. And we see that very much so now during the culture war, where you're not even allowed to talk to certain people. If you have Richard Spencer on, or if you have Nick Fuentes on, you're platforming Nazis. You're not even allowed to talk to them. You're not allowed to read their blogs. You're not allowed to engage with them. You're not allowed to watch the fake news. I remember as a kid, a leftist, being a part of being a leftist, part of the identity of being a leftist was we were open-minded. We were the ones who were willing to listen to people who lived different lifestyles than us and be open-minded to it. And now it's the opposite. It's you're not allowed to watch the fake news. You take pride in the fact that you never expose yourself to ideas other than those that you constantly are fed on TV. If you watch this news channel, you take pride in the fact that you never listen to anything from the other news channel, that you just make up these, you know, cartoon characters, supervillains of anybody who watches the other news channel. And you're smart enough to never even listen to them.
I can't even them right out of existence.
Yeah.
So, you know, that I had never heard that before, because obviously we understand what a pervasive problem this is in like left-wing ideology today, whether it's coming from higher education, whether it's coming from the echo chambers created online through social media or through the mainstream media. The religious tie-in that you just made is that, like, going out and exploring, which has always been something punishable in extreme forms of religion, is because it makes the management of the bewildered herd less efficient. Mm-hmm. Every single one of those opportunities, every single one of those bridges to somewhere else that might be built, that might turn a person curious, even not to the point of being unfaithful, but just of having their faith shaken, is too much of a risk to take, right? So it becomes part of a dogma that, yes, even though sometimes it might be harmless, but if you're planning for the cumulative effect of that, like 30% of humans in whatever herd you're trying to manage exercise some of their natural curiosity, what does that do to the cohesion of or the confidence in the dogma? And now we see that that is most apparent in like left-wing ideology, I would say.
Yeah, and I hate to make it a left-wing versus right-wing thing, but I do have to admit, my right-wing friends, they're more likely to explore ideas that they disagree with.
They just want to own the libs. They just want to own the libs. That's what, yeah. They're going out and looking for those people just so they can try to own them, Ben Shapiro style.
They'll talk to them, though. And my left-wing friends won't even talk to the right-wing people.
Yeah. I think those two things actually might be related, and I think it actually has to do with the appeal of Shapiro in one crowd and Trump in another crowd. These people love to watch their enemies just be rhetorically slaughtered, and by whether it's Trump style or Shapiro style or Crowder style, they're emboldened by seeing people like execute that over and over again, even sometimes in like pretty controlled settings. And then they want to go out and exercise it in public. And I think over the last 5 or 6 years, that desire has actually driven more left-wing people into like a retreat of like, you can't even talk to these people. They're just belligerent madmen. I know that the shielding for those same religious purposes that we just talked about, I know that's part of it. I know it's been part of it for a long time. But I think like the decline of discourse, the degrading of discourse in the last decade has also pushed those two groups further apart. So yeah, the right wing will go after left wing people just because they think they're super easy to own and make them melt down and rage quit.
And it also, just to tie it in, it also makes them more confident when they see Ben Shapiro go out and own the libs. It bolsters their confidence in their own belief system.
Yeah, it's more apparent on the left that people tend to wrap up their identity and their goodness in their politics. You know, whether it's the mask on their face or the sign in their front yard about like who's welcome in their house or what they believe in their house or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
That dialogue that is hostile is more easily interpreted as a personal attack, which is obviously something that a person who's trying to maybe get And not that there isn't an equivalent of this on the right, but somebody who's trying to get meaning from the belonging to this group or the holding of these ideas, if those ideas are attacked, it's a personal attack. And if somebody's fragile enough to need to like make their identity out of like the, you know, safest and most popular beliefs available right now. Yeah, I understand, even though I wish things were different, like how people interpret that as hostile when people question their beliefs, if their identity is wrapped up in their beliefs.
A little bit of that too, just to bring it back to the confidence thing. I've seen a part of the reason why I kind of left left-wing circles is because how quickly I saw them turn on each other.
Yeah.
How you're only allowed to have one opinion about any particular topic, and you can have 9 out of 10 proper opinions, but that one topic that you have the non-proper opinion about, they'll quickly viciously attack you over. As far as like confidence goes, I think that a lot of people that are attracted to that side of the tribal division is just quickly change whatever your opinions are to, oh, today Black trans lives matter. 4 years ago, my opinion about gay marriage was this, but today my opinion about gay marriage is this. And I think a lot of that just comes down to, again, those tribal things. I need to show the tribe that I'm part of them. I need to show that I'm confident in what they believe, even if I'm not really, because I might be left behind. If I show them that I maybe am not as dedicated to the tribe, as dedicated to the cult as they are, even if I'm secretly questioning some of this stuff, if I show it, they might leave me behind. The saber-toothed tiger might get me. The other tribe might attack me and I won't have anybody to defend me.
Because I have no confidence in myself, right?
Exactly.
And let's not, I want to be clear. I don't want to act like that's a property of left-wing ideologies. The lack of confidence is taught in K-12 schooling. Obedience, conformity, intellectual apathy as a result of those first two lessons. You're incapable of making your own decisions. You need to be in situations that you don't like, that you don't benefit from obedience. To survive in this situation, you need to align yourself with a group of people that you can seamlessly blend into conformity. And once you've outsourced all the personal responsibility in embracing those first two lessons, even though you don't get a choice as to whether or not you embrace them at a very young age, the result is an intellectual, spiritual, emotional, often apathy, meaning that you're just extremely malleable to the will of authorities or the will of a group.
And I don't know if I'd go so far as to say you're taught these things other
than implicitly.
Yes, but I also think that these things are just part of the human nature. It's things that are epigenetically in us from generations and generations back, and they're encouraged, they're watered, they're nurtured because it makes us easier to manage. The thing about it, I think about it like this. The way that I live my life is I kind of live my life the exact opposite of the way most people do. I'm not worried about fitting in. I'm not worried about being the nail that gets hammered. I mean, if you look at me, I walk into business meetings with people that are Harvard graduates and they have multi-million dollar businesses and I'm covered in face tattoos and I don't care. I'm like, hey, I'm me. I don't really care. You guys can deal with me or you guys cannot deal with me. It doesn't really matter. That's kind of how I live my life. Most people, that's very scary. And most people, it just doesn't fit for the way that they want to live their life. I remember very early on, back when I was a kid, I read a book by Banksy. Are you familiar with the graffiti artist Banksy?
Yep. Yeah.
So I was reading a book and he was talking about an experience where he was running from the cops and he was hiding underneath a truck and he was waiting for the cops to leave the area. And he was thinking to himself, how can I lay down my base spray paint or my base painting so I can come back and spray paint later? How can I lay this down and not draw attention to myself? And he was like, well, maybe I'll try wearing one of those city reflector jackets, one of those jackets that the city workers wear. And then all of a sudden he could go anywhere he wanted and he could just sit there and paint on a wall and he's wearing the city jacket and nobody asked questions. Nobody would call the cops on him. Nobody would bother him and he'd get away with doing his crime in broad daylight. And nobody thought twice because they saw the jacket.
Yeah.
Because He's an authority figure. He's got, all he had to do was act like he belonged there, go in there with confidence and be like, hey, I'm supposed to be here. And I remember reading that, and I remember going into like concert venues when we were trying to get booked for shows and just walking in there like I owned the place, walking in there like, hey, I'm on a mission. I belong here. I have confidence in myself. And just taking that attitude versus the attitude of, what if they tell me no? What if they tell me they're booked up this Friday? What if they tell me my music's not the type of music that they want played for their audience? What if all these things that I can be insecure about? Instead, just walk in there being like, hey, I'm a promoter. I'm somebody who's promoting this material. I'm here to give your fans a good time on Friday night. Walk in there with confidence, and you get a completely different reaction to people. When you're insecure, when you don't have confidence versus when you do have confidence, when you act like you belong there, just the way you present yourself completely changes the way people respond to you, react to you, and what they're willing to do for you. So just having that confidence, whether it's to manipulate a tribe or whether it's just to be the person that doesn't want to go along with the crowd, to be the person that plants the flag and says, hey, this is where I plant the flag. It may not be a popular opinion. It may turn off 90% of the population, but I don't give a shit. The 10% of the population that are willing to stand confidently behind me, I'm willing to die on this hill. That right there is a very sexy, very attractive personality trait for the vast majority of people out there who lack that. They're afraid, they don't have that for themselves. And if you can stand up and show them, hey, I've got something in common with you, and I'm courageous enough to stand up here, I'm confident enough to stand up here and plant this flag on this hill, people will go to the ends of the earth to defend you once they feel like you're the person giving them that confidence in that position.
Love it. So what you're talking about, I would say, very strongly relates to what is called in the red pill world or the pickup world, frame. Now, one of the things that you will learn in this world, and we haven't talked about this much on School Sucks, but I think there's a really good tie in here. These red pillars, they'll talk about shit testing, which is where a woman that a man is dating or is interested in dating will basically try to see through some, and a lot of this is done very unconsciously, and it's done even like biologically, I would say, for good reason. So a shit test, for anybody who doesn't know what this is where a woman will essentially try to see how easily she can break a man's frame. So a frame is the perspective, the presentation that a man or a woman or whoever is bringing to a situation. And this is kind of like where you get the, dudes trying to alpha each other to see like when there's going to be a frame collision, whose frame will break, to see who has the stronger frame. And I think what it comes down to, what you're saying, is you just have to be committed. You have to believe in your frame. And that means you have to understand your strengths. You have to understand your weaknesses and be accepting of them. There's a lot of Nathaniel Brandon's six pillars of self-esteem in this. There's a ton of living consciously, which makes those other five pillars possible. Like, you have to have a very high level of self-awareness, but you also have to be, like, if you look at somebody like present day example, Conor McGregor, past example, who is similar, Muhammad Ali. These are people who had a very high level of commitment to their frame, and people weren't going to come from outside and shake it or break it. They belonged where they are. They deserved the success that they had. They deserved more success than they had. But guess what, fucker? They're going to get it. Now, not everybody can pull that off. Obviously, I can't pull that off all the time. Most people listening might feel like that mindset is attainable, but often alien. Like Conor McGregor and Muhammad Ali, like, these are special people who've cultivated like that level of skill with frame control. But you going in there and presenting that way or acting like you belong there is having confidence and commitment to your frame. And also a mistake that I think we all make, especially as content creators or just from experience of growing up, a kid who was fat and thought I was pretty stupid. Like, I had to be funny. I needed something that would get me approval, that would open doors, like socially, that would make people like me. Otherwise, you're just the fat, stupid kid. So, you know, I cultivated a sense of humor, but I'm very aware that that sense of humor that is, I will tell you, very good. And I hope you'll all go listen to my other podcast, Portman Show. It was a means of seeking approval when I had a very low level of confidence in myself as a younger, smaller boy and man. So that's a program that runs in the background still. Like when it's say something funny, do the funny thing here. Like make sure all these people that you're with or these thousands of people who are listening to you approve of you. And sometimes it feels like it could be compensation, but it's something that I've become more and more aware of. And it doesn't mean like you have to turn away from it and not be like humor is a great asset, I think, to have. But its origin in my life was about getting approval, which means that I wanted to basically, I had no frame of my own and just wanted other people to kind of like let me into theirs in an accepting and approving way.
So I'm going to take that and then I'm going to maybe give a little bit of pushback.
Sure.
Or maybe a little bit of breadth to it. You started School Sucks Podcast. You jumped into a very new medium or media technology, and you started talking about a very unpopular point of view, especially at the time. The schools are poisoning our kids' mind narrative now is gaining popularity, but when you were talking about it at first, it was definitely not. That took a lot of confidence. That took a lot of, hey, I'm Brett Vinat, and I have a right to be here. My opinion is valid, and I'm building this community. I'm confident that I can lead these people not in the wrong direction. And the reason why I'm talking about that is it's such a rare skill. When you look at the workplace, a big thing that like anarcho-communists and socialists and people who fight for the idea of co-op and worker-owned businesses, one thing that they don't realize or that they're not willing to admit to themselves is most people don't want that responsibility. Most people aren't confident in themselves to take on the responsibility of making decisions. Most people say, hey, I want to show up. I want to fill out an application. I want to show up at my scheduled time. Tell me what kind of clothes I need to wear. Tell me when I need to be here. When I get here, tell me what I need to do and write me a paycheck. They don't want to be the person deciding this is the work that needs to get done to make sure that the paychecks can be handed out. This is the work that needs to get done to make sure that the business functions properly. This is the messaging that needs to be put out there. This is the branding that needs to be put out there. These are the taxes. These are the fees and the loopholes that we got to jump through in order to stay in business. They don't want all that responsibility. They're not confident that if they're given that responsibility, that they'll actually be able to do it. That's why 99.9% of the people just want to be an employee. And it's very rare that you find somebody who's willing to go out and start their own thing and go out and say, hey, I believe in this business and I'm willing to pay you. I'm willing to take on all the risk. I'm confident enough to build this business. And if you see the same vision, I'll make sure that there's a place for you in it, but you don't have to take on the risk. You don't have to be as confident as me. And the fact of the matter is 99.9, and that's a scientific statistic. I'm not just making it up. 99.9% of the population doesn't have that confidence. It's a rare person that does, and it can be abused, but it's also a very good I'm glad that there's people out there like you that started up School Sucks. I'm glad that I'm one of those people that has that confidence, because I think the world needs people that can do that. But I also know that that basic programming in us can very easily be taken advantage of.
So I agree with what you said, with your compliments of me, and I appreciate them. And I think like what made that transformation possible that kind of turned me into the boy I was describing a few minutes ago, into the man that started doing the show in 2009, was what I did between the ages of 21 and 31, which was working in education and being tested in all these ways. Like I wandered into a higher level of confidence to present this by, you know, coming out of my 20s, coming out of high school and college, coming out of those really lacking confidence experiences as a chubby, dumb kid was I went into that work wanting to be a good teacher and not seeking, seeking the approval of the people that I was teaching was part of it, but was really important at the beginning because I was still fairly obedient, needing the approval of authority figures just because I had never thought about these things really. I wanted to be good. So I kept looking for like the next most challenging and in some cases like outright ridiculous responsibilities that I could take on, like challenges that I could embrace. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in front of people, you know, being tested in that way and, you know, dealing with all the things that a teacher, you know, teaching inner city kids and rural Vermont kids with behavior problems and emotional problems would have to endure. Verbal abuse, physical abuse. One thing that kind of worked against my confidence was, yeah, I started testing myself and challenging myself as a means to get approval from authority figures. And number two, I think sometimes I did stay in situations that I didn't like for too long, but never permanently. And that was one of the greatest things, like just from working around ordinary employees and ordinary managers of people in those years. Like in education, you're going to deal with some really unimpressive managers of people and managers of environments. And if you're at all thoughtful, their shortcomings are going to stick out to you. And they're going to force you to ask questions like, man, is this place really run? Translates nicely to like a political philosophy later in life. Is this place really run by people who are this unimpressive? And one of the things that I think I did really for the sake of my own survival and my own sanity was to not shy away from believing in myself as a leader and trying to find and embrace leadership opportunities. Like, can I just be in charge of this place? And I was given a lot of, by the time I was like 24, I was given a lot of responsibility just because I didn't want to work for shitheads. And so I asserted myself as like, I'll be the leader. And that, I mean, it wasn't the most fun 2 years of my life, but it worked out. And I think it was all a meaningful and helpful part of that transition that got me to, you know, from not a good place as far as like self-image to somebody who was willing to, you know, do something like this by the time I was 31. So thank you. It's a long way of saying thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, you recruited me into your cult very early on. So,
yeah, yeah.
And I've been here the whole time supporting. You mentioned earlier, I kind of want to just emphasize this again, how important confidence is. We were talking about gold and money, the monetary system out there. And if you know anything about money, it's completely confidence-based. There's nothing behind it. It's fiat. It's not backed by gold. It's not backed by anything other than, I believe that if I take this money from you today, I'll be able to spend it and give it to somebody else tomorrow, and it'll still have most of its value. For the average person, that's why the monetary system stays in place, is because the devaluing of it, the inflationary aspect of it is so slow that they say, well, at least for these next 2 weeks, I'll work for you. I'll get that paycheck. And if I can spend that paycheck within 2 weeks after that, I'll still retain the majority of the value of what I... So I have confidence that when I take this paycheck, that when I work for you to get this paycheck, I have confidence I'll be able to spend it next week or the week after that, or maybe save a little bit of it for my retirement or whatever. The people that are buying gold, it's because they have more confidence that gold is going to retain the value than the money will. So it's all about confidence. It's the entire system of trade is based off of confidence. Why do we not use chickens as barter? Because chickens die, and I might not be able to get the same that I can get for a chicken today that I can for a chicken in the next 3 weeks. And I have no confidence that this chicken will have the same value, but I do have this confidence that this dollar bill will have the same value. Or I do have this confidence that this gold, this piece of gold or this silver will have more value 3 weeks from now than it does right now. And that's the entire monetary system is based off of, can we keep people confident in the dollar? Can we keep people confident in buying gold? Can we keep people confident in Bitcoin? All of it is based off of confidence.
Right. Chicken, by the way, is the figurative opposite of confidence.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that.
So where would you like to go next here?
I want to touch a little bit on current events, and we'll be vague about it, but I want to talk about why some of the marketing choices for, or the smear tactics for certain medications have been out there recently. I read a book years ago by, who was it that wrote Creature from Jekyll Island?
G. Edward Griffin.
G. Edward Griffin. He wrote another book called A World Without Cancer. Hmm. Have you heard of it or read it?
I've heard of it. I haven't read
it. It's freaking amazing. I don't know how much I believe in it, but I believe in it. And he talks about the cancer industry, the medical industry, and how in order to keep confidence in the ever-failing, you know, march for a cure, the multi-billion dollar industry that doesn't seem to be doing anything and hasn't seemed to do anything over the last 60 years that we've been funding it. In order to keep confidence in it, though, they have to constantly smear and remove confidence in anything that might offer some sort of threat to that industry. So if there's herbal ways to mitigate the harms of cancer, if there's things like CBD or Rick Simpson oil, or one of the things that he talks about in the book is vitamin B17, which comes from the kernels of apricots, I believe, bitter apricot kernels. If there's these things and there's tests out there that prove pretty consistently that taken correctly, they cure cancer, but there's a giant industry that needs to keep being funded and relies on these. They're looking for things that they can patent and things that they can make money off of and sell over and over and over again. And if there's these cheap products out there that are generic, that are easy, I mean, anybody can grow marijuana and make their own Rick Simpson oil. Anybody can buy bitter apricot kernels and eat those themselves. If those things work and they threaten the profits of these big giant pharmaceutical companies, if people found out and had confidence in that, then they might not keep giving money to the pharma industry. So part of their marketing is to constantly be battling against the confidence people might have in cannabis as a cure, or battling against the confidence people might have as the bitter apricot kernels as a cure. And we saw this just recently with, we've got these new vaccines and they're patented and we can get a bunch of money for selling these vaccines. The government's going to give us a bunch of money for everyone that we administer. There's also these therapeutics out there that seem to be maybe just as effective in fighting it, maybe even more effective in fighting it, but they're not patentable. They're past their patent date. We can't make as much money. We sell these ones, we can only sell them for $3 or 3 cents a pop. These vaccines, we can sell for $100 a pop. So in order to maintain confidence in the vaccines, which we keep seeing these breakthrough cases and we keep seeing people that are still getting sick, and now we're finding out that you can still spread it and you still have the same viral load. So in order to not shake the confidence, we got to keep people confident in the one that makes us the most money. One of the best things that we can do is just constantly attack and smear. And I'm not saying that I think ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, I'm not a virologist, or my only opinion comes from a business person's perspective and from a marketer's perspective. And if I want people to be confident in the shot that I can sell for $100, I need to do everything I can to reduce confidence in the medication that I can't patent, the medication that I don't have a patent on that sells for $3 or $3 for $100. I want to reduce confidence in those. And so over the last year and a half, 18 months, we've seen a giant exercise in managing confidence. We want to make sure the media is used to boost confidence in this particular solution to the problem, and just smear and denigrate and destroy any confidence people might have in one of these easier, cheaper, more available solutions that we don't have as much control over.
Right. So it's very easy to be labeled in this whole situation, in this whole investigation of what's happening right now. Obviously, it's very, very easy for someone to be labeled a conspiracy theorist as soon as they wander just a little bit off the reservation. And we see how liberally the anti-vaxxer label is being applied to people who are not anti-vax at all. And maybe not even taking a hard stance against this mRNA vaccine technology. Or the timing of starting to administer the vaccine while the virus is still circulating, which many people have theorized is actually like creating the variants, right? Because of this antibody dependent enhancement or this resistance. Like, those are theories, and I'm not going to assert, you know, one or the other in this show. It's off topic for us. But I think depending on like how conspiratorial you want to get, most people would agree mainstream media has a vested interest in maintaining a high level of viewer confidence in the pharmaceutical industry because of sponsorship. Now, you could say, well, you know, Pfizer isn't even a sponsor of this CNN program, but the pharmaceutical industry is a sponsor of CNN content generally, the industry generally, and CNN generally, or the mainstream cable news generally. So they have a motive to maintain confidence in the industry as a whole. Right now, they are making these vaccines. This is obviously a crucial, timely, urgent public health issue. So letting people in to this exploration of like, well, you know, what are the side effects? There's no long-term studies. Are there therapeutics? What benefits, what immunity do you get from having antibodies from already having the virus? Just think about it like a sales page, right? In the middle of a sales page, you wouldn't put hypertext that said, check out what my friend said about me on his blog and link them off your sales page. So in moving people down, viewers down, CNN viewers, MSNBC viewers, New York Times readers, various blogs, and even maybe like more corporate YouTube channels, Salon, Vice, any of these things, if they have this sponsorship or if they are part of an industry that has the duty of maintaining confidence in the pharmaceutical industry and in the government, you know, the funnel that they are moving down ends in confidence, and there's not going to be disruptions or exits along the way where people can get lost in these little curiosities and investigations. So, yeah. You know, what I laid out for people, because I've had to have some pretty crucial conversations with my parents, with my my girlfriend's parents, you know, a couple other people who were close to me around the decision of the vaccine. And this is something we talked a lot about in the university community. And I'll just insert it here because I know there's people who need help with this right now. And I'll just go off topic for 60 seconds. My speech is conclusion, part one, my standard of informed consent has not been met at this point to do an experimental medical procedure. So at this point, I'm still waiting and seeing. Number two, to act without informed consent means I would need to have a very high level of trust in the pharmaceutical industry, the mainstream media, the Biden administration, the Trump administration, and the big tech moderators of the conversation. So the Trump administration is a nice curveball. Number three, my standard for an honest and open debate about this technology, about other therapeutics, about risk, that standard has not been met either. So, you know, a question you can throw to your interlocutor there is, tell me how your standard of informed consent was met. Tell me about how these institutions earn your trust. Tell me why you feel an open and honest debate has happened around these things. But what you are encountering, if you have to have these conversations, is people who have bought hook, line, and sinker, that confidence scheme that we have been describing. That could exist, and I mean, it could be nefarious, it could go further than that, there could be more to this, it could be, you know, some large-scale global conspiracy. I'm not beyond entertaining or investigating any of that. But right in an accessible range for most people, the financial incentives are hard to ignore, and that for me is enough grounds for like curiosity, and at this point, cautious hesitation.
Yeah. So you and I are not the average people out there.
Right.
We don't get most of our worldview from the pharmaceutical industry sponsored corporate media. And so for a lot of the people out there, their level of confidence has been met. They've heard over and over again, 95% safe and effective, 99% safe and effective, 93% safe and effective. Even if it keeps changing, it's still whatever, whatever, giant percent safe and effective.
Percents are good.
Yeah. There's the problem agitate solution side of things where we just problem agitate, problem agitate, problem agitate, blow things out of proportion, scare the shit out of people, make the current situation so unbearable, so just riddled with uncertainty, fear, and lack of confidence. All I want is confidence that things will go back to normal. Mm. All I want is a sense of normalcy where I felt a little bit more confident about the economy. I felt a little bit more confident about the future. I felt a little bit more confident about sending my kids to the public schools. I want that confidence back. Can you give me something that will give me that confidence back? Are you confident? Are you 97% confident it's safe and effective? That's good enough for me. And then you add to that the easy and convenient. All you have to do is roll up your sleeve, get two shots, and then another shot every 4 months, and then two pills every day to go along with those. All you got to do is roll up your sleeve and get two shots, and it's that's it. It's like microwave popcorn. You throw it in the microwave, you push three buttons, you hit start. 2 minutes later, you got popcorn. We all want that. We want the microwave popcorn solutions. We don't want to do the hard work to sculpt our cores. We want a diet pill that does it for us. We don't want to do the hard work of whatever the case may be. We want a three-step simple solution that does it for us. All I want to do is roll up my sleeve, have you poke me, and then give me back that confidence and sell it to me with confidence. Tell me you're 97% sure it's going to work for me. Tell me you're 97% sure that I can go back to not having to wear a mask and not having to worry about sending my kids to school. If you can sell it to me with confidence and you can make it easy and convenient, that's why get rich quick schemes are so popular and will never go away. They're the bane of my existence because so many people look at what I'm doing and they're like, hey, how can I get started doing that and get the same results you're getting in 3 months from now? But that's what sells.
Yeah.
Someone wants confidence. And if you can make it easy and simple for them to do it, even better.
Yeah. So related to that, in current events, there's been some fun things to watch over the last weeks and months. Most recently, Joe Rogan touting these alternative treatments, being presented as an anti-vaxxer and appearing to be fully recovered and back to doing his podcast. And the concern trolling and the head exploding around that is, I don't mean to be schadenfreude, but there's a little bit of pleasure to be had from it once in a while. The other thing that's interesting, because I think it's a bigger picture thing, and it's kind of being played out through a couple of fairly bombastic personalities right now, is the Wuhan stuff, the lab leak stuff. And the personalities are Fauci and Rand Paul, and their occasional arguments in the hearing chambers of Congress. So you have to think that this Fauci is going to eat shit eventually. I mean, I think it was yesterday, The Intercept put out like 900 pages that, from initial reports, and I would need to look into this a little bit more to confirm. So it's not important for me to be conclusive here, just to make this point. People are suggesting that it looks like things are going to come down on the side of Rand Paul as far as like Fauci lied in front of Congress. First, that's never going to happen. There's never going to be a concession here. Fauci's not going to make a concession. He's going to double down. He is going to be more forceful with his language. He's going to call Rand Paul a liar. I resent you for what you're doing. You're misleading people. And even if they have to move their goalposts and admit that, like, yeah, we were funding gain-of-function research at this lab in the middle of a giant goddamn superpopulated city of Wuhan, they can still retreat to, but that, who even cares, it didn't cause the virus. Now, I'm not saying it's going to go there, but I just, like, as things happen and you see a development or you see a revelation, and that naive part of your brain goes, ah, this is where all my enemies eat shit. And then you go, wait a minute, no, it isn't. How? What is the escape hatch that they get through here? And that's what it would be. They would say, yeah, okay, it's undeniable. The NIH, through Fauci and through these NGOs, funded this gain-of-function research. But who even cares? We've been talking about this for a year, and that's not what caused the pandemic. So stop being hysterical, you crazy right-wingers who, if you had nothing to do, would just storm a Capitol building.
Yeah. Well, and it's the two tribes and the leaders of the two tribes. And as long as neither one shows any form of inconfidence, the tribes will stick behind them. The Fauci tribe will ignore the Rand Paul pieces of evidence, and the Rand Paul tribe will ignore the Fauci pieces of evidence. And Fauci, as long as he doesn't shake or waver in his confidence, doesn't matter how wrong he is, the people will stick behind him. Just like doesn't matter how many wrong predictions Alex Jones has, the Alex Jones tribe will stick behind him because Alex Jones was right about turning the frogs gay.
Right.
And Alex Jones was right about the chimeras, or I think that's the name of them, the half-human, half-pig animal hybrids that they're doing in China. Alex Jones was right 1 out of 8 times. And as long as he doesn't waver in his confidence about the 8 times he was, or the 7 times he was wrong, we're going to stand behind him for the 1 in 8 times. Fauci has been wrong and flip-flopped and changed his story a million times. But as long as every time he shows up, he still is this confident Fauci. I've led you astray 15 times, but we're not going to talk about that because this time I've got the proper course of action. The people who want to follow Fauci, doesn't matter what happens, doesn't matter what kind of evidence comes out, as long as he's confident, they'll still keep following
him. Which has been proven time and time again. Yes, we were tragically wrong yesterday, but how dare you not trust us today?
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically their presentation. Again, that's back to that frame collision that we were talking about. Like, these are two people who have so much at stake as far as like their identities are so tied to, like, Rand Paul has defined himself in a lot of ways, but in this context, I'm anti-Fauci, I'm anti-corruption, I'm anti, you know, this sanctimonious shaming people for trying to make their own decisions about their health. Fauci became popular for being anti-Trump, or being the anti-Trump as far as management of COVID was concerned. So these are two men, like actual human beings. Because they're almost like, they seem like legend beyond that at this point, certainly in this conflict, who have put themselves, I think, in a very, very difficult position of being defined not by what they stand for. And they didn't even do this to themselves. The media made Fauci this hero once they understood that he didn't get along with Donald Trump. That is why he has this status, why he is this saintly figure at this point. And it's just the more they double down on him being right and ignore his flaws because of that initial motivation, the more it builds him up and builds him up and makes him harder, makes him just more and more infallible. But God, sometimes it's almost like an interesting thought experiment. If Trump had just had the foresight at the beginning of 2020 to say, Tony Fauci, best guy in the world. Listen to everything he says. He's a genius. Where Fauci might be in jail now if Trump had done that. So anyway, Fauci became defined. I don't want to say he defined himself, but he became defined as anti-Trump, and Rand Paul became defined as, you know, anti-Karen, anti-Fauci. So now they're kind of stuck to these positions, and these are the frames that are colliding. And how one of them eventually doesn't break, I don't know. That's one of the things that makes it so interesting to watch.
Yeah, and maybe that's by design.
I don't know about Rand Paul, but I don't think there's real confidence there, right? There's definitely the solidity of a frame that has to be maintained, but I don't think it's genuine confidence. Maybe in both cases, it's more fear than anything else.
Yeah, and you know, I try not to be like a mind reader and draw my own conclusions but I do find it interesting to look at the public's reaction and try to figure out what is causing people to get behind Rand Paul, what is causing people to get behind Fauci. And for me, that's where all the interesting stuff is. And for me, that's where all the profitable stuff is, because I make a lot of money based off of being able to understand what triggers people to get behind what. And on both sides of this tribal line, there's good examples of people getting behind Rand Paul because he confidently planted his flag on that hill, and people getting behind Dr. Fauci because he confidently planted his flag on a different hill. And that confidence, man. And if it's okay, I would like to kind of transition into closing the show down. Sure. And talking about why this matters in sales.
Absolutely.
So one of the biggest problems I have with my industry, marketing advertisers, is their lack of confidence. A lot of times I'll go through different Facebook ads, or I'll go through ads in the magazine, and 9 out of 10 ads don't even have a call to action. They don't even have a confident, this is what I want you to do next. It's just, let me tell you about our product and please consider it next time you're in the grocery store. Whereas most of my advertising, I only will take on a client if I'm confident in what they're selling. So it's easy for me to take that confidence through in the sales page. But a lot of times where in sales copy, on sales pages and sales messages, sales emails, that's where people start to lose confidence, is right at the end of the message. When it comes time to ask people, hey, I want your money. I want you to pay me for this thing that I want to do for you. People get scared. They start to lose confidence, and they start using like weasel words, like, I'm pretty sure that this will work for you, or try it and see if it works for you, or we've seen some pretty great results and we think you might get those same results. They start using these weasel words like maybe and might and probably.
I got to ask my wife or husband. A sales guy I found really interesting, I mentioned him a few times in our mastermind, is Sabri Subi, who wrote a book called Sell Like Crazy. Quantum Growth is the name of his like sales and marketing course. And he says, this is an objection or a point of resistance. And it's back to the confidence, right? Because you said this is where people lose confidence, because when they actually see like the dollar signs and the checkout, they start overthinking, right? And overthinking is kind of the enemy of confidence. Like where action is needed, people go, more thinking, more practice, more rehearsal, more delay, more thoughts or questions or hesitations that just create friction in actually taking the action that I'm really pretty sure that I need to take. So Sabri actually talks about this, all right, I got to talk to my wife objection. And, you know, I think what he said about it was really great. It was really memorable. He goes, so after everything I just ran you through, this perfectly polished sales presentation that I've done all these times, and I'm an expert in this industry and I've analyzed your needs, you know, we've built this rapport and I'm ready to make a recommendation in good faith. You want to go relay some shitty version of everything I just did to your wife who doesn't want you to buy it. And then that's how you're going to make your decision? No. You get her on the phone now. And I love that, not because it's like, yeah, dudes, look out for your wives. They don't want you to buy things, but just very, very consciously calling out a form of resistance for what it is.
Uh-huh. So what that comes back to, though, is if people are looking for a solution, it's because they're not confident that they can figure it out themselves.
Right.
They're looking for someone who is confident, and they're looking for someone who makes them feel confident. If I'm going to hire someone to help me book a vacation, it's because I'm not confident I can book my own vacation myself. If I'm looking for someone who can manage my retirement, it's because I'm not confident I can handle my retirement myself. If I'm looking for someone to sell me a car, it's because I'm not confident I can pick out the right car myself. So I'm coming to you because I lack confidence. When it comes towards the end of the sales message, you start showing me that you're also not confident, okay, then you just failed. If we get to the end of the sales message and you say, this might be the thing you're looking for, or I'm pretty sure this will work for you, you've just shown me that you're not confident either. If at the end of the sales presentation, you're showing me you're super confident, you're just like all of these news people that we've been talking about, these politicians that we've been talking about, these cult leaders that we've been talking about, no matter what, they're still confident. Then I'm like, okay, I can overlook the flaws. I can overlook the 7 out of 8 times that Alex Jones has been wrong because he's confident in this thing and he's confident. And I'm in this world of, I have no idea what's going on. Everything that I thought was true about the world has just been turned on its head. And now I'm questioning everything. And there's this guy, Alex Jones, blurting off with a megaphone about how confident he is in his view of the world. Sure, he's wrong 7 out of 8 times, but he's confident, so I'm going to follow him. Rachel Maddow is wrong 7 out of 8 times, but she's confident, so I'll follow her. Bill O'Reilly's wrong 7 out of 8 times, but he's confident, so I'll follow him. This cult leader has said the world is going to end this date, and they were wrong. It was going to end this other date, and they were wrong. It was going to end this third date, and they were wrong, but they're still confident, so I'm going to follow them. Confidence is so important.
Or at the very least, right, because there's a whole inner world that's not being explored, because we can't explore it. We don't know these people. They're showcasing the mechanics of confidence.
Yes.
They've figured out how to present, how to commit. And it helps if, like, yeah, Alex Jones has a worldview. Rachel Maddow has a worldview. Bill O'Reilly has a worldview. And that helps them probably at least maintain the illusion of sincerity inside their own heads, like we talked about earlier. But through this kind of training and repetition, they understand the mechanics of confidence, right? And through trial and error, they know what works and they know what has to do. Some of them might get more training than others. Like Rachel Maddow might have had more training, while Alex Jones kind of had to figure it out on cable access television 25 years ago. But it's the mechanics of confidence. And
yeah,
as far as advice goes, fake it till you make it. There's lots of good free resources on, like, to your point that you made earlier, don't look for shortcuts. Like, a lot of this involves a lot of the work that we've been talking about on this show for years, like the 6 pillars and the other forms of inner work, to build a genuinely good self-image and try to project that into the world. But, you know, learning the behaviors and then trying to live into those behaviors, I don't think it's the worst approach. Confidence is a skill. People think about it like an attribute. And I know I've talked about certain aspects of myself in kind of a fatalistic way or a deterministic way, like, oh, you know, I'm one of these people, or I can't do this, or I can't do that, or I'm not good at this, or I have this aversion to that. Confidence is very much a skill set versus an attribute. And it has properties, it has principles, it has mechanics, and those things can be learned. And by practicing those things, I would say you can become a more confident person. That is the fake it till you make it, but it's better than doing nothing.
So I'm kind of against fake it till you make it, but I am a huge proponent of put the cart before the horse. Not so much be an imposter or be a fraud, but be willing to commit to something before you have it all figured out. Be willing to say, yes, I can do this, before you 100% know that you can do it. I always hated the fake it till you make it type of view, but for me, it feels much more comfortable just saying, hey, I might not know every single step, but I'm going to agree to give it my best shot. I'm agree to myself that I'm going to actually be able to pull this off, even if I don't know every single step of the way. So putting the cart before the horse is kind of my version of fake it till you make it, I guess.
And you did not misspeak there, because the cliche is don't put the cart before the horse, right? If the cart's in front of the horse, now you got to figure out how the horse is going to push the cart.
Exactly.
So this is actually an approach that I've come to admire more. Again, back to my hard audit of myself and how many things sat in a state of undone just because I kept reassuring myself that someday I'd figure out a way to do it perfectly. Well, here we are at the end. There's 2 episodes left after this one, and this one's over. A lot of things didn't get done here because it's like, yeah, keep thinking about that. Keep mulling that over. Keep generating, you know, these defeatist ideas of why that's not perfect yet. And someday it will be perfect. And then once it's perfect, you'll do it. And all those things didn't happen. So yeah, put the cart before the horse.
Also, look back at the last 12 years and give yourself some credit for a lot of the stuff that...
Oh yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, I totally agree. But you and everybody listening does not know all the stuff that didn't get done. And if I sat here for the next 45 minutes and read that list, you'd be like, oh, what the fuck did you do? But no, I agree. Well, and I graciously accept that compliment. I feel like this is the end of a great achievement here. But there's lots of lessons. That's why I talked about going through that critical process with myself, is like, don't get hung up in deliberation forever. Just start doing it and you'll figure it out. That's actually advice that in certain contexts I've given a bunch of times. Like when it comes to diet and fitness and stuff like that, today is the day. Today is the day. If you're not doing anything, today is the day. Don't wind up in traction, but figure out how to start safe and start.
Well, I'm just going to end the show and maybe end the series the way that I say we should end.
This will continue in some other form somewhere else. It has to.
Okay, it will. This
is one of my favorite things I've ever done. It has to keep going. The world keeps making more content for us to deal with. And yes, this will be the last free episode in the School Sucks podcast, but this conversation definitely has a future.
Okay, so whatever type of end that this is, I want to end it with confidence. And I just want to kind of go out with not beating a dead horse, but just kind of reaffirming confidence is key. Confidence is sexy. Confidence is one of the key factors that sets apart the people in the world who just live these mundane lives and never achieve anything from the people that just rocket out of the atmosphere. Confidence is something that, if you can learn to have confidence in yourself, if you can learn how to project that confidence onto others, if you can teach other people to be confident in themselves, you can do so much in the world. And it's disappointing that confidence is not something that's taught in the schools. It's kind of actually beat out of them, but it's so important. And also when it comes to tribal relations, when it comes to politics, when it comes to religion, when it comes to sales and marketing, confidence is the key factor that sets apart the winners from the losers. And when it comes to life, and when it comes to going out and starting a podcast that's going to reach and change the lives of thousands, tens of thousands of people, your podcast changed my life, Brett. I'm just going to say it. I'm a better person because of the fact that you had confidence to go out there and start the School Sucks podcast. And all of the people that have changed my life for the better, it's because they had the confidence to go out there and do something that impacted and made my life better. And the same thing for the people that hit me up and they're like, dude, you taught me how to do this, and now my business is crushing it. And thank you for having the confidence that even though you weren't the best salesperson in the world, you were willing to share what you knew, and that made a difference for me. And the world would be better served if more of us had more confidence in ourselves. And so I guess just to close this off, I want to close it with confidence. I'm very proud of my contribution to what you've done over the last 12 years. I'm very proud of you for what you've done over the last 12 years. And I just want to say, I'm confident going forward, whatever you do next is just going to be amazing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. And I really, really appreciate everything you've done to contribute and help along the way and help behind the scenes. And I'm definitely excited to keep working with you. And we will. I know that. And I know there's one thing that I want to reiterate here at the end of the show. And I get that there's some irony of talking about this on something called the School Sucks podcast. But one of the most important attributes of confidence is to not be reactive. In other words, to not define yourself. In the world of ideas and in the climate of crucial conversations, which is probably more intense than it's ever been, don't define yourself. Don't identify yourself by what you're against. My friends at Online Great Books were recently talking about Nietzsche. We were talking about Nietzsche actually before we started today, and this idea of magnanimity. What do you stand for? What is the good you are for? Don't define yourself by the evil that you think you fight, because if that becomes your frame, your worldview, you could wind up supporting a lot of wickedness in the name of fighting against it. I talked about that, defining yourself by what you're against or getting defined by what you're against in terms of like Rand Paul and Fauci. But think about it in your own presentation, everybody. Like, there are important things that you have to talk to people about. Give them hope. Give them optimism. Talk about the good that you stand for. It's very, very easy to be against all kinds of things. It's never been so easy. But stand up for the good.